I'll be reading to you from the Gospel of John this morning, chapter 19, verses 1 to 16. You can find that in the Pew Bibles on page 755 and also on the screen. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. Once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the priests and the officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify!" But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to set you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews, but they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Hey, thanks for reading that. My name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to start, if that's okay, with a relatively sensitive comment. Some in the past have misused passages just like this one to justify anti-Jewish sentiment in the modern era, that these passages have sometimes been misused for the purpose of anti-Semitism. To put a strong guardrail against that, I've just thrown up a quote here from Kevin DeYoung. I'll just read it to you. "Especially on the other side of the Holocaust, we want to make sure in reading the Gospels that we understand that there's no blanket denunciation of the Jews as a people. In fact, you have to remember that John is a Jew, and he's writing this book to most likely to other Jews, either to those who are seeking to know more about Christ or who are young converts themselves. And so there's no way to portray this book as anti-Semitic." I'm going to say a quick prayer before we get stuck into walking through verse by verse through these scriptures. God, I pray that you take this time, you'd make it useful. I pray that you'd impress the things that you want to be impressed upon our hearts today. Everyone who agreed said, Amen. The plan for today is really simple. We're just going to walk verse by verse through the Bible, sitting underneath it, not trying to put ourselves on top of it. I think the thread that ties all of this together is the idea of power. This whole thing drips with power. In almost every verse, somebody is trying to exercise power over somebody else. Somebody is trying to push back on another person's power to instate their own. And so one really helpful way just to see this text really clearly is to say, who in this verse is attempting to exercise power? With that as introduction, if you've got a Bible, let's have a look at verse 1. It'll come up on the screen if you don't have a Bible. "Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. Soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. Who's trying to exercise power in this verse? It's a very simple answer. There's physical power in the most brute, obvious form. It's being exercised by the soldiers against their prisoner. There's an artistic depiction of this, which is going to come up on the screen. This is Dirk van Boren, van Baburen. It's Kroenig mit den Dornenkroon, which is just king with the thorn crown. This is not in any sense close to being a photograph. This is just an artist's depiction of what's going on. But it does give you a sense of the exercise of power, doesn't it? Raw, brute, physical power that Jesus is willingly subjecting himself to. Have a look later on in verses 2 and 3. They clothed him in a purple robe, purple the color of royalty, and went up to him again and again saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. This is power of the most obvious form. This is mockery. When you think about a slap there, you could think about, you know, a gentle tap on the face, but maybe this image in recent pop culture is a little bit more familiar to you. This is a little bit closer to what's happening. This is pure, straight-out aggression, maybe rage from the soldiers who have to put up with leading these people as the Roman occupiers day in, day out. Come to verse 4. Ask yourself, who's exercising power? Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." Pilate is in charge of these soldiers using physical force, but he comes out here to say, "I'm in power here, and here's my judgment. He is not guilty." Remember that they've brought him to Jesus particularly because they're outraged by his blasphemy, which is kind of a spiritual crime. Pilate is not interested in the spiritual as it pertains to that area. He's interested in whether this guy has committed treason, whether he's setting himself up as a king. And from last week, you will remember, if you were in the room, "My kingdom is not of this world," at which point Pilate says, "This guy is not a threat." And so he comes out and he says, "I'm in charge and I find no basis for a charge against him." Verse 5, "When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, 'Here is the man.'" Here's the artistic depiction. It's called Ecce Homo. This is Antonio Cesari. It gives you some sense of what's happening here. Now, why is Pilate bringing Jesus out to be presented to the people? It seems like the whole idea with having him flogged as somebody who he found to be not guilty is to satisfy those who are calling for him to be punished. Pilate is thinking, hey, if I have him flogged, if I then present him as somebody who's been beaten up, mocked, then maybe, just maybe, these people will be satisfied and we can get this whole thing off my plate. So he presents Jesus to them, hoping that they'll be satisfied. But verse 6, they exercise their power, the power of the crowd, the power of the masses. Verse 6, "As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, 'Crucify! Crucify!'" That's how they'd say it if they're Australians. But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." They're saying, "We don't accept your power here, Pilate." He says exactly what he says back in verse 4. He's laying his claim to be the one in charge again. So verse 7, they introduce a new source of power into this discussion. Verse 7, the Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claims to be the Son of God." Anyone in the room work with the law? Anyone work in legislation, all those kind of things? You will know that something that has been written down or something that has precedent, there is a certain power in that. They're claiming here and they're bringing in particularly their spiritual law. If you're looking for a direct reference, it's probably Leviticus 24, around about verse 16, which talks about blasphemy. The thing that they're upset with Jesus for is his blasphemy. And particularly, if we could bold up this statement, they're upset because he's claimed to be the Son of God. Can we take a pause here for just a second? Every week in this room and in the overflow section, shout out to you guys, there's plenty of room, you can come in when you want. It does look very full from the back though, doesn't it? But up here you can see there's plenty of seats. They're upset because he said he's the Son of God. If you're still considering the things of faith, and there's people doing that every single week here, you've got to wrestle with who is Jesus, actually. Here's the thing. For many people, we say, oh, Jesus was a great religious teacher. We say Jesus was a lovely guy. He was a good bloke. We say Jesus would make a great foundation for a kind of a good education system. We can raise people on the kind of ethics that Jesus teaches. And you could say, yeah, probably, but he's so much more than that. And really pointedly, he claims to be the Son of God. Option one, this could all be fabrication. This could be a legend. It didn't actually happen. Maybe in the second, third centuries AD, somebody stood to gain by upgrading the severity of everything Jesus has claimed. Maybe Jesus never actually claimed. Maybe he wasn't a real person at all. Maybe at the very least, somebody kind of built him up to be God, even though he never claimed to be. Maybe all of this is just legend, option one. Option two, maybe he was a straight-up lunatic. Maybe, like many people throughout the world today, he was out of his mind such that he thought he was divine. And somehow, he was charismatic enough or the people were naive enough to follow this lunatic claiming to be the Son of God. Maybe it was a legend. Option two, maybe he was a lunatic. Option three, maybe he was a straight-up liar. Maybe he knew exactly what he was doing, but he was great at manipulating people. Maybe he knew he was nothing special, but he gained something by making himself out to be a Son of God. So he knew he wasn't, but he said he was the Son of God. Option three, maybe one, he was legend. It didn't actually happen. Maybe two, he was a lunatic. Maybe three, he was a liar. Do any of these pop for you? Because if they all start to fall down under close inspection, which they have for me, you end up with the very significant and quite uncomfortable recognition that maybe, just maybe, that was actually true. Maybe, just maybe, this guy wasn't legend, lunatic, or liar. Maybe he was the Lord. And what's crazy about the whole situation is that if he is the Son of God, couldn't he do something about all of this? Why is he subjecting himself to all of this craziness? Verse 8, let's pursue power again. When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid and he went back inside the palace. Where do you come from? He asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. Here's an artistic depiction of what this might have looked like. This is James Tissot. You can see this in the Brooklyn Museum. Jesus before Pilate. Who has power in this situation is surely the one in robes, seated. Jesus is bound before him. The one in robes has the power of those on the right-hand screen at his disposal. And yet, there's something in Pilate at this moment that's become afraid. Something perhaps superstitious in his idea that the Son of God is a significant title. Verse 10. Do you refuse to speak to me? Pilate said. Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? Part of the reason, by the way, that Jesus is staying silent on purpose is the fulfillment of Scripture. Back in Isaiah chapter 53, it was prophesied that the Messiah would be like this. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. And yet in this moment, all Pilate can talk about is power. And he's asserting that I have power over you. Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? And verse 11 is very significant. Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." Can we pause on that idea of given to you? At this point, can we take a doctrinal sidebar actually for a second? We've got to clear something up. It's very significant for all of our reading of the Scripture, and it's on display in this moment. It seems that God gives Pilate the power. what we're saying here is that Pilate, in some sense, is executing God's will, as evil as it could be. This leads us in many moments to ask ourselves the question of, is Pilate just a robot acting out? Does he actually have free will? Do I have free will? How does the world truly work? And it brings us to the doctrine of compatibilism. I heard another theologian call it the doctrine of concurrence recently. Here's the idea. When you read the Bible, if you're sitting under the authority of God's word, you've got to take seriously both of the things in these circles. That God is sovereign and we have human responsibility. We say Pilate has been given power. Firstly, he's been given power by Caesar because he's just ruling in Caesar's name. But ultimately, Jesus is saying, you've been given power by God. He's saying all power is ultimately derivative, but that does not mean that people are free from responsibility. That does not mean that your actions don't matter. It does not mean that the people who were playing out God's plan were not ultimately responsible human agents. When you read through the whole Bible, you've got to hold these two things together. They seem at first glance like you've got to choose A or B, but sitting under the authority of the scriptures, we realize that they are truly compatible. Both must be true at the same time. Pilate is working out God's plan A, which is to let his son die on the cross for all of humanity's sin. Come with me to verse 12. Let's keep thinking through the lens of power. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free. Notice that he tried to. His power is incomplete. But the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar." A very significant phrase. If you were in charge of a Roman province, you really wanted to be classified as a friend of Caesar. And they're saying, "Hey, Pilate, you're not invincible either, mate." Backstory to all of this is that Pilate has obviously been appointed by Caesar. If word gets out to Caesar back in Rome that Pilate's lost control of his place, or that Pilate is allowing other people to say that they are kings, suddenly Pilate's position and maybe his very life are in jeopardy. And they say, hey, if you do that, you're not a friend of Caesar. Who ultimately has power here? It's the one who's not even in the room. It's the one who's not even in the city. They're saying, you know who has power? It's the one who controls armies. And you, Pilate, are out of step with his power. And in that moment as well, it's the religious authorities. They're trying to manipulate. They don't really care about Caesar. Caesar has conquered their own town. They would do away with Caesar in an instant. But what they're doing is manipulating the truth. They're throwing some of it up. They're playing some of it down to try and get what they're after. Verse 13. When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat on the judge's seat. Notice this. Everything's getting out of control, so he searches for a symbol of power that he can attach himself to. There's this thing apparently called the judge's seat. This is where the power is. The one who sits on the judge's seat, they have the power. It's the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. Verse 14, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. Verse 15, but they shouted, "Take him away! Take him away! Crucify him!" "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. And in this moment, they totally lose the plot and they say, "We have no king but Caesar." Chief priests answered. The whole thing is chaos. The scene might have looked a little bit something like this. And in this moment, everything has gone crazy. There's power being thrown from all angles. No one's really sure who's in charge. And the whole thing ends in verse 16 like this. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. Now, just think for a second with me. One of the weird things about this whole interaction is how inactive Jesus is. Everyone else is making their power claims. Everyone else is asserting that they're actually in charge and people have to listen to them. Jesus, at times, is just silent. He only really seems to say one line, which is a corrective about the very nature of how power works. And yet, if we really believe that not only does he go to the cross to pay for the sins of humanity, but then he rises again to prove that it worked. Ultimately, the most powerful person in this whole scene is Jesus himself. And with all of this having been walked through, I'd love to only draw two very simple points of application for us today. The first one is to those of us who have power in a worldly sense. I would ask you, are you able to recognize the power that you have in a worldly sense? Firstly, in this room, in this part of the world, and then in this part of Sydney, if you are a resident of Coringa, you are likely, in socioeconomic terms, to be high in power in some way. Some of us in the room have power as CEOs or employers or managers. Some of us have power as parents. Some of us have power through the affluence that we wield in society. Some of us have positions where we get to set the rules of engagement about how all of this works. It's been said that people who have power are often the most blind to how power works. So just pause for a second and ask yourself, in the eyes of the world, do I have power? Now, what do we learn from today's passage? First one is we learn that all power is derivative. Simple point. All power is ultimately given to us. You might have been put in your position of power by another person, and ultimately behind that we can see the hand of God giving power to all people. And the very simple call would be something like this. As a holder of power, submitting to the ultimate power, what would it look like for you to use your power in a Christ-centered way? What would it look like to use your power like Jesus used his? I'd love to offer a comment about work, actually. Sometimes we forget, on a Sunday, we forget to talk about Monday through Friday. A lot of us during the week, your regular week is you are working for a company or you run a company, you're working for some kind of institution. And if you really think about it, a lot of our work has to do with the acquisition or the distribution of power. You help people have power. You know, if you work with glasses, you help people be able to see. If you work at Centrelink, you work in the redistribution of power. Lots of us have to do with power in our workplaces. And I guess my question for you, and this is going to be so general of a question because all of our situations are so different, question would be, what would it look like to guide your company or to guide your institution towards a godly approach to power? What would power look like exercised in a Christ-like way in your Monday to Friday? The second application I want to offer is the exact opposite, which is to those of us who feel that we have very little power at the moment. And you say, I don't feel like a powerful person. I actually feel quite powerless. It's true to say that many of us have suffered injustice recently, haven't you? In the past week, in the past months, in your workplace, in your family, in your street, in your social interactions, you have been a sufferer of injustice. And it's very reasonable that you feel low on power. If we could just rehearse the great truths of the scriptures, in the end, the place where we're going, if you are connected to Christ, is a place where there is no more injustice, where all power interactions will be sorted out because there will only be one undisputed powerful person on the throne, and we will all be giving our worship and adoration to him. And right now, we can take comfort recognizing that Jesus knows what it's like to go through injustice. This is what we see today, isn't it? Everything about this trial is off. Everything is wrong. And if you were to identify as somebody who has been through injustice, I don't say this lightly, Jesus is with you. His suffering is not yours. You have suffered in your own specific ways. And yet, he knows what it's like to suffer. Band, you guys can come up. We're going to finish with these lines. Have you ever considered what it would be like if Jesus, the Son of God, came to earth and hadn't suffered, he would be a powerful person who had no idea what it's like to be us. But here's the reality. The one who has power over death itself knows what it's like to be powerless. The one who has ultimate power used his power for your salvation. We're going to sing about those truths right now in Jerusalem. Would you like to pray with me? God, we worship you as the God who actually is in control of everything. We worship you as the one who willingly sent your Son to the cross for our salvation. God, we ask that we would be able to work out the effects of sitting under your power as people who do have power. Help us to influence our workplaces for good. And God, we ask for those of us right now who are feeling incredibly powerless that you would bring deep comfort here today. And everyone who agreed said... Thank you.